The polls were wrong. The pundits were wrong. We'll try to figure out what happened on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. An extraordinary campaign comes to an extraordinary end.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. And this is so important to me.
The obvious question, how did Trump do it?
They were really going to places where they thought their voters lived. And one of these sources a week ago was saying, we really think our types of voters are in Michigan, Wisconsin, and in parts of Pennsylvania. And by that, I think they meant not the cities. They meant rural white voters.
Plus, what do you say to those who can't come to terms with the election results?
Certainly, one of the things that I always say, denial is very powerful until it stops working.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 153 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. We've been doing this kind of stuff for a very long time, and we thought we've seen everything. But never did we see a presidential election where everyone got everything wrong. We'll get to the victory of Donald Trump and the Republicans, and the defeat of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, shortly. Not every Republican had a good week. Take Chris Christie, for example. He already lost his shot at the Republican presidential nomination. Then he was passed over as Trump's running mate. Now, two top former aides were convicted for their role in Bridgegate, the scandal-slash-scheme in which lanes to the George Washington Bridge were blocked by a fake traffic study in retribution for the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee failing to endorse Christie's re-election in 2013. The testimony at the trial seemed to indicate that Christie knew of the plan, but the governor, who was not on trial, insisted he had no involvement. Here's Andrea Mitchell of NBC News reading an excerpt from Christie's statement.
Let me be clear, once again, I had no knowledge prior to or during these lane realignments and had no role in authorizing them. No believable evidence was presented to contradict that fact. Continued to say, anything said to the contrary over the past 6 weeks in court is simply untrue.
And Janet Reno died. She was the nation's first female attorney general, who served the entire 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency. Fiercely independent and known for her integrity, she sometimes clashed with the president, usually over the controversies or scandals the administration would invariably find itself in. She was probably best known for two other contentious events: the decision to launch the assault against the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, that resulted in the deaths of about 75 people, and the decision to reunite Elian Gonzalez, the 6-year-old Cuban boy whose mother perished when they tried to flee to the U.S., with his father in Cuba. She also unsuccessfully sought the Democratic nomination for governor of Florida in 2002. And how could we ever forget the Janet Reno dance party, where she was spoofed by Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live?
It's time for the final episode of Janet Reno's Dance Party.
Oh, Janet, I can't believe I have to say goodbye. What do you do when you get sad?
I just dance. Now hit it!
And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last U.S. Attorney General who was elected to public office after leaving the cabinet? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Generals and majors are harder than ever too far from battlefields and glorious. Out in a world of their own, they'll never come down to once again victorious. Whoa, generals and majors always seem so unhappy unless they got a war. Generals and majors are hard like never before. I'm tired of being actionless.
Before the returns started coming in, the questions most people were asking were, what's next for the Republican Party? And what happens to Donald Trump, whose takeover of the GOP set back their chances for winning the White House for the foreseeable future? How wrong we were. Now the question is, what next for the Democrats? How did an election that seemed so assured for Hillary Clinton go so wrong? And why did all of us miss the anger and alienation that was out there? Joining us with little or no sleep are Greg Giroux, a political reporter with Bloomberg, and Lisa Desjardins, the political editor for the NewsHour on PBS. Lisa and Greg, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
Great to be here.
I should let everybody know we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, and so the shock is still there. It may still be shocking when people listen to this show, but Lisa, I think we all agree that it was stunning, and we could probably explain now how he did it, but why did everyone, all the pundits and the pollsters and the analysts and the experts, why did we all get it wrong?
I think there were a couple of demographic shifts that did not go Democrats' way that they thought would. And I think if you look at race, Donald Trump did 3 points better with white America than Mitt Romney did. So he won more with the white vote than Mitt Romney. That's a big deal because, of course, the white vote this year was about 70% of the vote in this election. The black vote, that has been what has gotten Democrats across the finish line. Barack Obama, that's what put him in the White House. The black vote, Hillary Clinton did 7 percentage points worse than Barack Obama. And with Latinos, Hillary Clinton did 5 percentage points worse. So you have, for Democrats, kind of a three-sided storm. The Republicans did better with whites than they had in the past, and they did worse with blacks and Latinos. So that right there is a big problem. But I think we also have a class situation here, guys. And when you look at, when I looked at these states that were in play, the blue wall that was going to keep Hillary Clinton, get her back into the White House, I looked at this map and I said, this is really a new map. What's in common here? What's going on? And the strongest correlation I can find to these states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, that went Trump versus blue wall states like Colorado that went Clinton, is if you look at the percentage of college-educated white women who showed up at the polls. If your state had more college-educated white women, the state went Clinton. If it had more non-college-educated, it went Trump.
And that was Mitt Romney's strongest group in 2012, right? Educated white women.
Yes, that's right. But in this election, these states went Trump if you had more non-college educated white women. And so that's really, so what we're talking about there is sort of a mark of class and a mark of, you know, sort of the education level of states and perhaps the economy of a state as well. And Donald Trump did well in states that had more non-college educated women. And so this is a new look. And to be honest, in the conversation about disparity, in the conversation about divides, that's not necessarily a great thing for America. We're moving apart at the seams that were already there.
I think what was really striking about the Trump victory was just the unusual coalitions, the unusual kind of block of states he put together and how well he did, how much better he did in certain states compared to Romney versus others, like doing at least as well in Ohio as in Texas. Winning states.
Or
like
doing better than Mitt Romney in Michigan.
Exactly.
Romney family territory. It's amazing.
Right. And I haven't studied the exit polls, but I did compare some total votes in some key counties. And one that really jumped out at me was Milwaukee County in Wisconsin, where the number of people who voted was just dramatically down, I think over 100,000 people from 2012 to 2016. And that's a state that Donald Trump won the first time a Republican has carried that state since 1984.
Lisa, we saw President and Mrs. Obama campaigning in Pennsylvania to try to energize a black turnout. That gave me an indication that they were worried about something, because the early numbers were, at least the early voting returns we were hearing, was that there was going to be a very enthusiastic Latino vote, maybe in Florida a big black turnout. But when I saw Trump campaigning in Michigan in the final days, I figured either he's just losing it and is just going unhinged, or he knew something that nobody else knew.
Yeah, you know that Trump. So my main assignment this election season, you know, we're public broadcasters, so we all do a lot. But my main assignment has been to cover the Trump campaign, and for the past 2 weeks, I've had some good Trump sources telling me that their internal polling was very different than the public polling, like not as is usual, which there's usually a lag anyway between public polling and internals, but they were saying this is beyond that. We think these public polls are just way off, because I was having that exact conversation. I was saying, what are you guys doing? Michigan? You know, what?
Minnesota and was they close. Said,
that's right, Minnesota. And there was actually a point, too, I don't know if you remember this, where they were looking at New Mexico, and they felt like New Mexico was coming onto the board. That didn't happen, but that was something they were really looking at. And I think that this goes to show that they actually did have a really good internal polling operation, and that it wasn't just this. For a while, I was thinking, well, they're just hoping that they're throwing darts at the board, hoping that they hit one. No, they were really going to places where they thought their voters lived. And one of these sources a week ago was saying, we really think our types of voters are in Michigan, Wisconsin, and in parts of Pennsylvania. And by that, I think they meant not the cities. They meant rural white voters, Rust Belt voters, but not exclusively Rust Belt voters. I think maybe that narrative has been a little overstated. We're talking about rural white America, and that has had economic problems, and those are what those states have in common. That is where they thought they had some ground. They did also admit that they thought the initial James Comey letter really helped them. And it wasn't so much that it changed minds, but that people who may have been about to vote Clinton but were very uncomfortable changed. It fed that narrative in a way at an important moment. And they felt it helped them, especially in these sort of northern rural states. They thought it made a difference.
You wonder, Greg, what do you make of James Comey? I mean, he, you know, whether he absolved Hillary Clinton ultimately or not, he brought back that conversation about emails. And, you know, Bernie Sanders said he's sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails. And I'm sure Hillary Clinton agreed. But we were talking about her damn emails throughout the end of the campaign.
Yeah, and you really can't put the horse back in the barn after you do that. Here we are in the waning weeks of the campaign, and you know, Clinton wants to end on kind of her terms and on her strategy and her issues and what dominates the conversation, and the FBI and the emails. And even if Comey said the nature of the investigation was no different than what it was in July, it's, you know, it's still out there, it's still lingering. And even if the FBI found no criminal wrongdoing, it still just kind of plants some seeds of doubt into the mind. It just changes the conversation. It's something they had to bat down. It was a distraction to them when they wanted to be talking about something else.
Lisa, I see a whole bunch of reasons why Hillary Clinton may have lost the Comey intrusion, perhaps the WikiLeaks leaks, the rising premiums in Obamacare. But it was more than that. Hillary Clinton had more problems than just those things. Correct?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, to me, what I haven't come to a conclusion about personally is how many of her flaws were truly inherent and how many of these are what I call campaign flaws, which are true issues that a candidate has, but which in the glare of a campaign seem way more prominent. Almost like you're almost say as if you were on television in bad lighting. You know, I think that sometimes we overstate candidates' flaws in campaign years. Imagine that. And I'm still in my mind trying to reckon with what about Hillary Clinton is something that really is inherent year in, year out as a flaw for her as a candidate, and what is something that opponents make a lot out of, or that because of, say, a cultural bias, like maybe sexism, comes to light in a campaign year and seems like a flaw that's inherent, but really is something else at work. I think she has both of those issues. I think some of the things that people push back at her about, like saying she's not relatable or she doesn't have as much charisma as Donald Trump, there's foundation for both of those things, in fact, but both of those are influenced by something like sexism. So I think it's very difficult to say. I know this, that when Hillary Clinton is a candidate, she is incredibly unpopular when she's first running for an office. When her husband is. when she is in office, she has been incredibly popular, both as a senator, as a secretary of state. So I think you see in her own life sort of a double standard of how people look at her. Very capable executive, but not someone that you're comfortable voting for on the first try. And obviously, there's nothing with higher stakes on a vote than the vote for president.
Greg, I always think back to the Donald Trump statement last year that he said that I could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and I would not lose any support. You've been around. You've watched candidates say an impolitic thing and their candidacy would be ruined. But Donald Trump has basically made a cottage industry of saying incendiary things about women and Muslims and Mexicans and the disabled and fellow Republicans. And it never seemed, we would always say, okay, this time he's crossed the line, but he's never seemed to cross the line. And when Lisa talked about the Access Hollywood tape and the women who have coming forward to sue him for assault, and they say, okay, maybe this time it'll make a difference. It didn't make a difference. Something outweighed all that.
Yeah, I mean, the things that, if we had to take like any one of the things he said or did and, you know, brought it back, say, 20 or 30 years, one must think that that candidate would have been a fatal political blow. I mean, we've used the term, what, a Teflon candidate or a Teflon president for decades now. And I think that definition just keeps changing and changing because it seems like, Trump is the ultimate one. Things that you'd think that would disqualify a candidate or at least would cause that candidate to suffer significantly in the polls, it turned out not to be the case.
Lisa, Greg just mentioned the polls. Why? I always think back to the so-called Bradley effect, where people will not tell the pollsters who they're really voting for. But why, aside from an LA Times poll, why did it seem like every poll just got it wrong? And if anything, Hillary Clinton's lead seemed to be increasing.
Right. That's a question. I don't have an answer for you on that. But I
Lisa, I demand an answer.
Lisa,
I
know. I'm
if you're going to be on my show, you have to answer these questions.
I'm going to do a poll about why the polls were wrong.
Okay.
I do think, Ann Seltzer in Iowa actually had some decent polling that was showing that Trump was up, and in fact up by more than he ended up winning by. I do think the pollsters have got to look at their models and figure out what they missed, or is it the Bradley effect? I don't know. Maybe that's one reason Trump's internals were closer to the mark than the public polls. I don't buy the argument. I think I would love to be able to say, oh, there were so many late deciders. That's why they missed it. Everyone made up their minds very late, and you can't capture that in a poll. I'm not convinced that's true, especially looking at exit polls. It looks like very few people ended up making their mind up in the last week or last couple of days. So I think there's something more going on there that we have yet to figure out.
Greg, we know that Donald Trump has said some amazing, pretty amazing things on the campaign trail. He's talked about how Washington is broken, and it probably is broken, but he's also alienated many of the people he needs to work with. Let me play a little part of his winning speech, victory speech on Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning, and let me hear from both of you what you think about it.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory. And I congratulated her and her family on a very, very hard-fought campaign. I mean, she fought very hard. Hillary has worked very long and very hard over a long period of time, and we owe her a major debt of gratitude for her service to our country. I mean that very sincerely. Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
Well, I mean, obviously, that's what somebody needs to say who's declared a winner in a divided country. But, guys, what do you, Greg, let me start with you. What do you make of that conciliatory speech?
Yeah, I mean, it's your classic kind of gracious, you know, congratulatory speech. It is kind of discordant to hear it from his voice after the kind of campaign that was run. But if you imagine some other winning presidential candidate just saying that's the kind of thing you hear after a winning campaign. The question is, what's the follow-through once he actually becomes the president? You know, what are his State of the Unions like? What is his inaugural address? What kind of themes is that going to strike? What kind of Trump are we actually going to see in the White House? Is it the Trump that kind of lives up to these ideals that he underscored in that clip you just played, or will it be the Trump who won the nomination and was all that just an act to win the nomination? I'm just really curious to see what kind of Trump is going to be in the White House, and what kind of people does he surround himself with, legislative staff, that sort of thing.
Lisa, the kind of the Donald Trump who talked about appointing a special prosecutor to throw Hillary Clinton in jail.
Right. You know, I think Donald Trump, you talked about him being able to say things that other politicians generally would not be able to say without suffering major consequences. I also think that he has baked into his persona as a politician the idea that he has made radical shifts in his beliefs and radical shifts in what he says he'll do. You know, among those, of course, is abortion. He used to be pro-choice, and now he's very pro-life. So I wonder if he could pretty easily say Hillary Clinton was very gracious and, you know, I appreciate her. Like he said last night, she ran a hard-fought campaign. We should be grateful to her is what he said last night. I think there's a space and even incentive for him to say, I'm going to be magnanimous and I'm going to say we need to keep having hearings. Congress should do what it wants to do, but I for now will not appoint a special prosecutor. Let's let Congress handle this. Who knows? It's Donald Trump. I don't know. If he wants to appoint a special prosecutor, he definitely will. But I think there's a way for him to not do that and for everyone, for his voters to shrug it off because he in the past has done a 180 and he's been able to explain it or shrug it off and it hasn't left a mark on him.
Well, here's Hillary Clinton Wednesday afternoon in her official concession speech.
Last night, I congratulated Donald Trump and offered to work with him on behalf of our country. I hope that he will be a successful president for all Americans. This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for. And I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country. But I feel pride and gratitude for this wonderful campaign that we built together. This vast, diverse, creative, unruly, energized campaign. You represent the best of America. And being your candidate has been one of the greatest honors of my life. Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America. And I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it.
Greg, when I first asked you to come on the program, I think the question I asked you was, and we could talk about the future of Donald Trump. Well, I think we know what the future of Donald Trump is now, but what's the future of Hillary Clinton?
I really don't know. I don't think she'll be a presidential candidate again, but I'm not sure what's in her future. I mean, maybe a philanthropic public activities, things like that, a cause or two that's very dear to her. What I do think is that her unexpected loss, creates an extra challenge for the Democrats, and that they now have to, there's a greater urgency on them to kind of bring in the new generation of leadership. Who are the next big faces of the party? Now, this has always been an issue for Democrats the last few years. I mean, their leadership is, their leaders in the House are veterans. They've been there a long time. Bernie Sanders, her only opponent, was in his mid-70s. He's probably not going to run for president again. And if Hillary had been elected president for 4 or 8 years, I mean, she would have led the party and been the face of that party. Now, with President Obama, going out of office and Hillary Clinton suffering this stunning defeat, who is going to be in this next batch of leaders for the party?
Lisa, do you any Democratic names of the future come to mind?
Yeah, I think there are some names out there. I do think that I get in this conversation all the time with Democratic sources who are trying to recruit candidates, and I say, "Oh, why don't you guys have a deeper bench?" And they say, "Oh, we do have a deep bench." I think the new U.S. Senator from California, Kamala Harris, is someone to watch. She's going to be only the second African-American woman in the U.S. Senate in history, and she's a great campaigner and candidate. She's got a good life story. She's definitely a Democrat to watch. Kirsten Gillibrand has been on that list for a long time, but I'm not sure if she's interested in the job. That's still a question mark, possibly. I think there's a lot of other candidates out there that we could talk about, but I think in general, Greg is right. The Democrats sort of need to develop their next level bench. And I think this next year, that's one thing I'm going to be watching for. Who is it that emerges as someone who is effective in voicing the Democratic platform and philosophy against Donald Trump? So, we went into last night having all these questions about What is the Republican Party going to do? What's the Republican Party identity going to be after tonight? Now we are looking at what is the Democratic Party going to do? What is the Democratic Party identity going to be after a year where they had not one but two DNC chair people face major questions about their fairness of use of that office, one of them resigning? So, the Democrats have a lot of soul searching to do. I think they do have some folks who could rise to the top, but I just don't think that bench is quite there yet. This next year is going to really be a test for them.
Elizabeth Warren is a name that comes to mind. She may not be the youngest person, but she's still seen as a fresh face.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's true. I think she decided not to run this year for a variety of reasons, and in 4 years, she is a real possibility. She also has something that I think only one other person has to their credit, which she's landed a punch on Donald Trump. 17 people ran for to be the Republican nominee. 16 of them could not land, or 15 of them could not land a punch on Donald Trump, but Carly Fiorina did. So I think just Carly Fiorina and Elizabeth Warren were the only real successful critics of Donald Trump on the trail. So I think Elizabeth Warren is someone we'll see a lot in the next year. And we'll see if the path takes her to interest in being the nominee.
Lisa, biggest surprise?
Biggest surprise. It was all a surprise. The biggest surprise, I think, is that you had in the presidential election a revolt against Washington. Then you had everywhere else in the Senate and the House, status quo. Very little change in the Senate and the House. And I think that's sort of at odds with what voters were expressing at the top of the ballot. I think that the Trump race is a real sign of how unhappy voters are with Washington, and in some cases, how desperate they are for hope And I think Donald Trump offered hope to a group of people who felt they had not gotten it in many years. I also think that Trump voters have just been really generally misunderstood and stereotyped in a way that we've got to get past now.
Lisa Desjardins is the political director for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, thank you so much for being on the show. You're wonderful.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And Greg Giroux is a reporter with Bloomberg. And Greg, as always, you are the best. Well, so is Lisa, but the two of you made this post-election show fantastic. I really appreciate all your insight.
Thank you. Great to be tied for first with Lisa.
Thank you both. Whenever I would appear with Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation's Political Junkie segment after a major event, there was an excitement the two of us shared, knowing we would get to talk about it on the program. This time, the excitement is almost replaced by numbness. It was probably the most stunning upset in the history of presidential elections, or at least in our lifetimes. We got Neil on the show this week, and Neil, wow, right? I think the word I'm looking for is wow.
Or shocked or stunned is good. All of that. This is the biggest political upset of my lifetime anyway, on the presidential level.
I mean, I think it's big. I think it's much bigger than George Pataki winning the governorship of New York, right?
I think so.
I think so. When I was thinking, the last time we had you on the show was the week of September 7th. This is before the debates. Before Billy Bush became part of the lexicon.
Or James Comey, for
or
that
James
matter.
Comey, right, before James Comey. So tell me, what's happened since then?
Oh, has anything happened? It is remarkable. Back on September 7th, the polls were close. This was right after Secretary Clinton had her difficulties with her health. Donald Trump had closed the gap, and then after the first debate, it widened way open again. It closed after the third debate, the Comey letter, and it looks like the polls detected a rebound by Clinton in the past few days. Obviously, that was false news. We didn't see that. I didn't see it coming. I honestly thought she was going to win going away.
Well, something. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with people over the past 24 hours. We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, but the shock is still there. But why? How did everybody just get it wrong?
I think people put a lot of credit, I certainly did, into the extraordinary work of what we thought was going to be a tremendous get-out-the-vote effort. That effort that worked so well for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 was going to work again. And clearly what we're looking at, and again, people will know a little better as they look at more refined versions of the exit polls over the next few days. But clearly what happened is that the Democrats and Hillary Clinton did not get out her vote. Republicans, for the most part, turned out. They came home to their party. Democrats just did not turn out in the numbers everybody expected them to. Not merely in the proportions. Yes, fewer college-educated whites voted for Clinton than thought. The black vote was down a little bit from what Barack Obama got. The Hispanic vote, we're going to have to see more about what happened to that. It looked like they turned out in record numbers. That was not enough. Women did not turn out for the first woman presidential candidate in the numbers that people expected. The voters that Donald Trump expected to come out and vote, they came out to vote. Hillary Clinton supporters did not.
And when we were listening to all those reports about early voting and how the Democrats were really inspired and Latinos were coming out in record numbers, and the point you made about all the money she had in her Get Out the Vote effort, the organization, mm-hmm. whereas Trump, for the most part, seemed to be winging it. Okay, I'll go to Michigan, although I'm thinking, why do you go to Michigan? You don't have a chance
why
there.
Why do you go? Turned out he had good reason to go to Michigan.
Yeah, exactly.
She ran what was technically I think, a flawless campaign. The Democrats mounted a terrific convention in Cleveland, and far better than the Republican convention. She won every single one of the presidential debates. She mounted that get-out-the-vote effort.
It seems like I agree with you. I think Hillary Clinton ran a flawless campaign, but she was a flawed candidate. And I think...
Oh, absolutely.
But so was Donald Trump. And I think some exit poll I saw showed that even among voters who thought they were both seriously flawed, overwhelmingly of those who voted in that and made that choice chose Donald Trump.
And what clearly we overlooked was the extent of the anger amongst people who thought they were overlooked by the elites on the West Coast and the East Coast, the intellectuals, the media, elites of both political parties. Middle America, to some degree, stuck its finger up, its middle finger up, and voted for Donald Trump, even though they thought he was a deeply flawed person, a deeply flawed candidate, and even though he may make a deeply flawed president. We're going to have to see. They voted for change, and I think change is what they're going to get.
Well, he promised a lot of change that, first of all, I mean, remember when he was running, he was going to appoint a special prosecutor to put Hillary Clinton in prison. He was going to make Mexico pay for the wall. He was going to deport 11 million people here illegally on the first day of office. There's one thing to make a lot of campaign promises and employ a lot of campaign rhetoric. It's another to make it happen, as you know, the difference between campaigning and governing. And also, he kind of spent much of the campaign attacking the people he's going to have to work with now, like the Paul Ryans and the Mitch McConnells of the world. Can he do that?
I have no idea. And I don't think he does either. And I don't think they do either. This is we've never been here. I think what we did learn about Donald Trump is that he is not a person to forget or forgive what he perceives as slights. I do not think he will forget that Paul Ryan disinvited him from that campaign appearance in Wisconsin after the Billy Bush tape came out. I don't think he's going to forget that Mitch McConnell held him at arm's length as if he was some kind of soiled sock. I don't think he's going to forget that the Republican foreign policy establishment, almost to a man and woman, said they opposed Donald Trump. I don't think he's going to forget any of those things, but there are things that a president can do on day one, maybe not build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. Obviously, he needs Congress if he hopes to appropriate the money to build a wall, but he can reverse President Obama's policies on things like protecting the dreamers, the children who were the people who were brought in illegally as children. He protected them from being deported. Donald Trump can change that. On day one, he can change the way federal agencies enforce the immigration laws. He can change the executive orders that President Obama signed to protect the environment. He can repudiate the NAFTA agreement. I think he's going to do that. He committed to do it, and I think he has to do it to shore up his supporters. And, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what he does.
But what about the other issues that a lot of Republicans had problems with Donald Trump, such as his disdain or seemingly disdain of NATO or his seeming embrace of Putin? I mean, that's anathema to all what Republican orthodoxy is all about.
Absolutely. And I think honestly that he's going to try to reassure American allies, but I don't think that's a bell that can be unrung. There has to be deep worry in the NATO fringe countries, the Baltic states and Poland. There has to be deep worry in Ukraine. There were clearly clear that Trump activists removed the clause in the Republican Party platform that called for arms to be sent to Ukraine. Japan and South Korea now have to be seriously considering whether or not to start building nuclear weapons of their own because they have to doubt the extent of the American commitment to their security. The Saudi Arabia, if he tears up the treaty with Iran, does Saudi Arabia try to either build or acquire nuclear weapons? It's a new world. Those things are and just as much. A Supreme Court that everybody thought would be turning toward, for the first time in many, many years, toward a moderate or liberal majority. The Supreme Court is going to be changed for another generation. It's going to be conservative for another generation.
You suspect that Merrick Garland is not going to get a vote?
I don't. Merrick Garland will be confirmed the day that Donald Trump releases his tax returns.
Isn't that something? I mean, I remember so many Republicans saying maybe the best deal we can get in a lame duck session, let's vote to confirm Merrick Garland, because what we'll get from Hillary Clinton is far worse. And now, I mean, the thought of Donald Trump having his own Supreme Court nominee just seems so... it couldn't have been imagined, 6 weeks ago, let alone 6 months ago.
26 hours ago,
right?
As we speak. And, the other thing, don't you think this vindicates Mitch McConnell's strategy of refusing to even consider the appointment by President Obama of a Supreme Court justice in his last year? This has now become the political norm.
I was just going to ask you that, because I remember there was so much pressure on, like, Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, whose job it was to vet and vote on Supreme Court nominations, and he refused to do that. And everybody said that would be a big issue in his reelection campaign. Well, one, he was reelected overwhelmingly, and two, the Republican Party didn't pay for that Merrick Garland thing. Actually, as it turned out, they lost the Mark Kirk seat in Illinois, which we kind of thought. They may lose Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, but that's it. I mean, there's no Evan Bayh didn't come back. Russ Feingold didn't come back. Some shockers in the Senate races.
The three Republican senatorial candidates who lost yesterday were all candidates who repudiated Donald Trump.
Like Joe Heck in Nevada, for example.
Exactly. Kelly Ayotte, who looks like she lost her race. And
Mark Kirk.
And Mark Kirk in Illinois.
Right. You live in the Democratic Republic of Hawaii, which is considered, some people consider it a part of the U.S. But, you remember very well one of the issues when George W. Bush was leaving the presidency, and when the election of 2008, Obama promised a less cowboy-like foreign policy. But even at the end of 8 years of Barack Obama, there are a bunch of American allies who really didn't feel that the U.S. was doing what it should have done or could have done to, keep its status in the world. What does Donald Trump face with these allies and everybody around the world, given the fact that he was so dismissed by everybody throughout the campaign?
It's going to be a difficult period for him if he cares. If we read back into what he said for decades, he seems to advocate a more isolationist foreign policy for the United States, a less engaged United States, to pull back from, its...
Which is a popular position. That's a popular position.
It is a popular position, and to pull back from bases in places like Japan and South Korea and Germany. It's going to change the alignment if he indeed does that. At the same time, he promises to build up American military forces. So it's going to, I think one of the most interesting countries will be Germany, which has played, been able to play a very muted role in Europe and on the world stage because it was living in the shadow of American power. Germany, I think, is going to have to start asserting itself much more as the most important nation in Europe, which it is economically and politically, and is going to have to become a more prominent role in NATO now that the United States is apparently going to be playing a less important role in NATO. Japan becomes extremely interesting because Japan now has to establish a independent foreign policy, more independent from the United States than it ever has been, along with places like Australia as well. And of course, South Korea is, are they in a bind. They have a president who's enmeshed in scandal herself, and the threat of North Korea right across the border, which is clearly working towards a workable nuclear weapons system designed to conquer South Korea.
Neil, before I let you go, let me just tell me, because I've made it clear how I'm feeling in this wacky, surreal day after the election. Compare your view, your state of mind the night before the election to 3 o'clock in the morning, on Wednesday, to even now. I mean, it seems to be some shifting. I I've gone through such unbelievable emotions in the past 48 hours.
I am right there with you, except for the time difference. it happened earlier here. I had to get up early to do an interview, so I probably got just as little sleep as you did. But no, it feels like I'm scared. I honestly don't know what to expect. We have elected a president who's the majority of the people in the country believe is unqualified for the job. He's a person who's proved himself to be willfully ignorant, disdained preparation for the presidential debates, for instance, clearly does not know a lot about politics, or certainly about running a government, and listens to very few people except for his own gut. And I'm worried.
And he won. All the things you listed, he did everything wrong. He didn't prepare for the debates. He didn't have a good campaign organization or structure. He made questionable decisions about where to campaign. And he won. He insulted women and minorities and Muslims and Mexicans and the disabled. And he won.
And he won. And what does that say about the electorate, that they were willing to overlook all of that for some amorphous idea about change and getting theirs back against the elites who've been running government in Washington, D.C. for, well, decades now?
Neil Conan is a former host of Talk of the Nation on NPR. He's a news analyst on Hawaii Public Radio, and he appears on The Political Junkie the first week of every month. Neil, it's been too long without you, and can't wait to talk to you next. Thanks so much.
Talk to you next month, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our trivia question from 2 weeks ago, which was, who was the first presidential candidate to win New York and California and still go on to lose the election? The answer, Al Gore. He won both states in 2000, but lost the election to George W. Bush. And the randomly selected winner is Paul Hamilton of St. Catharines, Ontario in Canada. Paul wins the coveted Political Junkie button. I will be sending him the button along with a lot of my disappointed Hillary Clinton friends. And we have a Scuttlebutton puzzle winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. In our last contest, the first button was from Skip Bifalis, a Florida Republican running for governor. Then a 1972 Nixon button from New Jersey that read TNT. Tomb, Nixon, Trank. By the way, here's a fun aside. Nixon's brother Donald gave me that button. How do you like that? Finally, I had to resort to a baseball card from Philippe Ballou of the Milwaukee Braves. So when you combine Skip and Tomb and Alou, you kind of get Skip to Malou, the old children's song. The winner is Selena Blackwell of Salisbury, Maryland. As always, check out our website for our latest campaign updates, scuttlebutton puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Lost my partner, what'll I do? Lost my partner, what'll I do? Lost my partner, what'll I do? Skip to Malou, my darling, gone again. Skip to Malou, gone again. Skip to Malou, gone again. Skip to Malou, skip to Malou, my darling.
We know it's been a tough couple of days for some of our listeners. The election, shall we say, may not have gone the way you would have liked. Truth be told, given the toxicity of the campaign, there has been no shortage of angst and fear for weeks now. So we thought we would check in with Sue Elias. She is a licensed clinical social worker based in Manhattan. Sue Elias, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hello. Nice to be here.
When I first invited you onto the program, this was after everybody was going through all the angst of what was going on during the presidential election, And I think that when I invited you, I thought, well, now that the election is over, people can start to exhale. But I suspect from, at least if my emails and phone calls are anything like yours, people are not too willing to exhale.
To the contrary, I think yesterday was like this arc. As people were in for sessions, they were feeling this wonderful relief, jubilant. You know, they were going home to watch history being made. It didn't even enter their minds that, you know, this might not be the outcome. And I started getting texts and emails about 8:30 last night with people just getting sinking feelings that they needed to reach out. Could this possibly be happening? Oh, my God. You know, asking if they had old prescriptions of Xanax, would it be okay to take? Because they had maybe had a drink. They just couldn't take it. And as it went on, well, you know, through the election, I was really getting an influx of just despair to disbelief. And when I got up this morning, I checked and I just had flooded with, you know, people saying they're afraid to look, they can't take it. Just the disappointment, it was overwhelming, and being in shock.
What were you hearing from many of your patients and maybe other therapists during the campaign itself? Because that was also pretty intense and it aroused intense feelings.
Certainly. Starting in the summer, people started to bring in their fears that could this really happen. And depending on their backgrounds, depending on their individual issues, because there were so many things you could pick from, whether it was, you know, misogyny issues or racial issues or climate change issues or just general bullying, that people were expressing concerns and worry relating to him, and then bringing it back, obviously, to things that may have happened in their personal life that made these particular areas more upsetting for them than others. I also saw a lot of couples fighting and a lot of people having difficulty with their parents, and this started to really intensify during the summer. And it got progressive as the election cycle went on.
Have you heard from fellow therapists about how they're handling it and if they were also deluged with these kind of situations?
Interesting, because as therapists, we're usually trained, you know, to keep our political beliefs, you know, to ourselves. And in this election, what we really, as therapists, I think, found is that that was impossible because we were challenging such core values about honesty, about integrity, racism, misogyny, that it really started to be a dialogue between us. How much do we share and in what ways and what's appropriate, and that we all needed support from each other. And we've never had that in another election in all my experience.
It seems like from what we're talking about, it seems like most of you, if not all of your clients, are Hillary Clinton supporters or Democrats. But at the same time, we have to realize and recognize that perhaps half the country, maybe more than half the country, were Donald Trump supporters. And they saw something in the system that wasn't working and they wanted that kind of change. So when you talk to your clients who are just so depressed and distressed, how do you think they react to the fact that at least half the country saw the election a different way from the way they did?
Certainly, one of the things that I always say, denial is very powerful until it stops working. I mean, I know that we were aware that certainly there was a big part of the country, certainly the Rust Belt and where more uneducated people who really were believing all of the magic that he was putting out. But I think our hope in what they were saying to me is the same country that elected Barack Obama. How could they? It just can't happen. So I think there was something, there was a sense of possibility, but a lot of self-soothing that people would come to their senses. Each next, you know, thing that happened that was just so out of line, you know, the kind of put people over the edge of feeling this just, you know, thank goodness. He now, you know, people will not be able to vote for him. And I think that that's why it was such a shock, because there were just so many episodes of things where you felt like Could it get worse? What could he do next? That common sense just felt like, you know, somehow this couldn't be, that there were enough people that would find this just too appalling.
Is the election of Donald Trump good for Sue Elias professionally?
I would really hate to look at it that way. It may be, because obviously people are very troubled and they seek therapy and they, you know, it's important. It is what I do. But I would really prefer not to have had that be a boom for my, you know, therapy practice.
Before we decide that everybody has to consider the end of the world as we know it, let me play a little bit of President Obama from Wednesday for him, listening to him talk about the future.
Now, everybody is sad when their side loses an election. But the day after, we have to remember that we're actually all on one team. This is an intramural scrimmage. We're not Democrats first. We're not Republicans first. We are Americans first. We're patriots first. We all want what's best for this country. That's what I heard in Mr. Trump's remarks last night. That's what I heard when I spoke to him directly. And I was heartened by that. That's what the country needs. A sense of unity, a sense of inclusion, a respect for our institutions, our way of life, rule of law, and a respect for each other. I hope that he maintains that spirit throughout this transition, and I certainly hope that's how his presidency has a chance to begin.
Sue, that sounded very soothing, didn't it?
It did sound soothing, but what I think is problematic is I know that, of course, he needed to make a speech like that, and he did it with dignity and class, which we all would expect. But we also know that a week ago he was saying a guy who can't handle a Twitter account shouldn't have his hand on nuclear weapons. So we can't have amnesia about all the things that were said, because it's all lovely, and maybe we can try to have some sense of, now that the race is over, that maybe that will become more civilized, his dialogue. But, you know, this has been such a long election, and President Obama has been very clear about his feelings that he does not feel this man is capable or has the temperament to be president, and that is kind of hard to be soothed by his hope that he will, you know, be a better man now. I hope so, don't you?
I guess the final question is, if people start calling this show for prescriptions for Xanax, can I give them your number?
You definitely can, that's for sure. But I also am trying to really help people to say there have been some wonderful things written that I found today that are certainly about how to go forward, and that we do need to grieve, and that that's normal, and that process, and, you know, some very inspiring things. And my daughter, who's a teacher, interestingly, their principal gave them this wonderful article on what to tell your children. And I found it so great. I just sent it out to a lot of my patients because it was very soothing.
The people who are mourning this week, there's hope for them, yes?
Yes, I do believe there is hope. I don't think I could do what I do if I didn't believe in hope.
Sue Elias is a licensed clinical social worker based in Manhattan. Sue, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Thank you, Ken. I enjoyed it.
Faces, don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama. Cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it. Don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can also follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.